Welcome to the ODI Monthly Podcast, bringing you the views on the news from the Overseas Development Institute. I'm Jonathan Tanner, and this month we'll be looking at a plan to get Syrian refugees in the Lebanon into school, looking at how we can better support governments to deliver public services, and following the UN General Assembly, taking a look at the latest in the post-2015 negotiations. In last month's podcast, we looked at how an increasing number of refugees are living in urban environments and cited the example of Lebanon as somewhere where this was happening. In the last month, ODI Director Kevin Watkins has visited Lebanon to look at how the growing number of Syrian refugees in the country are affecting the school system. In a report, Education Without Borders, Kevin sets out a plan to avoid the sort of business-as-usual approach which he warns could lead to a lost generation of children failing to receive an education. The report was commissioned by the NGO A World at School. It states that if Lebanon's refugee children were a country, they would have the world's lowest enrollment rate. A meeting was convened in New York by the UN Special Envoy on Global Education, Gordon Brown, to discuss whether the plan could become reality. It's received a favourable response from UN agencies, including UNICEF and the UNHCR. I spoke with Kevin Watkins about why this is such a pressing issue and how we might go about solving it. I began by asking him why he decided to undertake the trip.
Well, I was invited by the Lebanese government to go and have a look at the situation in education facing Syrian refugees, and by the UN Special Envoy for Education, Gordon Brown, the former Prime Minister. And the concern is that, of course, there are many of these refugees are children, and they're children who have already had a really hard time. You know, they've been uprooted from their homes, they've missed a lot of education already. They're arriving in a strange country. And Lebanon is a very small country dealing with a very big refugee crisis. This is probably the biggest refugee crisis since the Second World War. Lebanon is right on the doorstep. It's really under an enormous amount of pressure politically, socially and economically in trying to tackle the refugee problem. And what I was trying to do was working with others to look at what could be done in education to help Lebanon adjust and to ensure that these kids who have suffered enough don't lose out on their education.
We live in a world that unfortunately isn't a stranger to crises. What is it about the situation in Lebanon, even compared to countries like Turkey and Jordan, which have also absorbed quite a few refugees? What makes the situation in Lebanon particularly different and need extra attention?
Well, I think what hasn't been sufficiently understood in the rest of the world, that Lebanon is a tiny country. It's smaller than Wales. It's got a population of around 4 million. And it's already absorbed around 1 million refugees. Now, if you try and imagine what that would mean in the United Kingdom, you're talking about the United Kingdom absorbing the whole of the population of Belgium or more. Or to put it differently, it's like the schools in London with the same resources, the same buildings, having to absorb all of the kids living in Manchester and Birmingham, as well as the kids who are already in school. So the fact that it's a tiny country, that one in four of the country are already refugees from Syria, and there's no sign of the flow of refugees abating. So yeah, this is an issue that's going to get worse over time. It's a country that's desperately struggling with resources. You know, how do you absorb an increase in population on that scale? How do you deliver health services? How do you provide shelter? How do you provide health and education? And it's absolutely clear, you know, I mean, Lebanon's not a poor country. You know, we're not talking about South Sudan here or the Democratic Republic of Congo, but it's not a country that is equipped to absorb this many refugees this quickly. And if the international community doesn't step in and help, there's a real danger that we could see a social and political implosion in Lebanon.
There are systems to deal with these sorts of crises. You talk about the international system needing to step in and help. Has it not done that at all?
Well, it would be overstating it to say it hasn't done it at all. The humanitarian community has moved, it has mobilised resources. The UNHCR, the UN High Commission for Refugees, is providing support to part of the refugee problem. We're seeing organisations like UNICEF stepping in, and there's a whole range of NGOs that are operating on the ground, often in very difficult environments. The problem is twofold. The first is the scale and the pace of change. Nobody has seen anything on quite this scale happen quite this quickly. And so part of the problem is the response time. And secondly, the humanitarian system is there really to deal with emergencies, with the emergency aspect of the refugee crisis. What we're moving towards is a very long-term emergency type of problem. These people are still going to be there next year. They're probably going to be there in 2 years. Now, how do you fund a response to a 2 to 3 year problem when you're dealing with emergency financing response mechanisms, you know, 6 month emergency appeals, 3 month emergency appeals? So there's a big misalignment between the resources that are available and the needs on the ground.
During your trip, you spent some time in Beirut. You also traveled to the Bekaa Valley. Can you tell us a bit about some of the experiences that you had and the things that you saw on the trip that make this such a compelling cause for you?
Well, the thing you're always struck by, I think, when you speak to refugees is the extraordinary resilience they show in the face of what are overwhelmingly difficult circumstances. And I spoke to a lot of parents in the Bekaa Valley and to a lot of children. And one of the things that really struck me, you know, these are people who have been uprooted. I spoke to a lot of people from rural areas just outside of Damascus who had seen terrible violence, who had arrived in Lebanon with virtually nothing. The first thing they start doing is trying to rebuild their lives. And as part of that, they're absolutely desperate to get their kids into school. And the innovation and the ambition and the resilience they show in trying to get their kids into school is very moving, actually. You know, these are people, they'll go out there in groups of 10 to 20 parents and try and hire a teacher. You know, they'll try and find a small classroom somewhere where they can get their kids into school. You know, they'll pull together to get some books for their kids. And it's really important, I think, because the problem is so enormous, because the numbers are so big, it's very easy to forget the personal human tragedies that are behind this. I spoke to kids of 12 who'd lost brothers and sisters, who'd lost parents, who were trying to keep their opportunities for learning alive. And I think the international community has responsibilities here. You know, we talk about the right to education, we talk about the rights of refugees, but in order to make those rights real, we need to put resources on the ground and we need delivery mechanisms that make it possible for kids to learn.
We both know that there are major challenges in delivering effective education in poor and ill-resourced countries at the best of times. We're talking about some of the worst of times for people in Lebanon. You know, how do you go about starting to build a plan that does deliver education in this situation?
Well, the specific problem that Lebanon has is that it has a very small public education system. Actually, most of the education in Lebanon is private, and only something like 20 to 25% of kids in the country are going to public schools. Most of the refugees who are being registered by the UN agencies who are coming into Lebanon are desperately poor. They need support. That's why they're registering as refugees. And the fact is that there are something like 300,000 kids, Lebanese kids, in Lebanon's public schools. And these schools now have to absorb something like 350,000 Syrian refugee children. In other words, the school population has to double. And unlike the situation in Jordan or in Turkey, where many of the refugees are being concentrated in camps, in Lebanon, the authorities, because of the experience with the Palestinian camps in the past, are very concerned not to have big refugee settlements operating separately. And they're trying to absorb these kids into the public education system. But of course, that puts immense pressure on resources. Now, there are various things that can be done to mitigate those pressures. You can go over to what are called double shift systems, where you run one set of classes in the morning and another set of classes in the afternoon. Some people even argue you could go to a triple shift system where you do some classes in the early evening. There's a certain amount that you could do through community centres, you know, recognising that you can't go to double shift overnight, but you can hire the local community hall. You could hire a Syrian teacher to go and provide some basic education in that community hall. But all of this, it takes resources, it takes technical ability, you need books. And there's an additional problem in the Lebanese case, because the curriculum in the Lebanon is taught from very early ages in English and French, as well as Arabic. In Syria, kids learn solely in Arabic. And so you've got kids coming into Lebanon, 8, 9, 10 years old, who may have lost 1 or 2 years education already. They've been through traumatic circumstances, and now they have to learn English or French before they can restart their education. And you've got agencies like Save the Children and Islamic Relief who are running what are called accelerated learning program classes, trying to give kids basic English and basic French so that they can get back into the education system. But again, this takes teachers, it takes books, it takes classrooms, it takes desks. And these things, you don't drop out of thin air. They have to be paid for. And many of the agencies that are equipped to scale up their operations, like Norwegian Relief, like Save the Children, like Islamic Relief, just don't have the resources on the scale they need them. And this is really something that the international community has to step in and get behind their efforts.
One of the biggest frustrations politicians often mention is a frustration with the ability to get things done. There's a lot of factors that combine to make it difficult to ensure that the state is able to achieve the outcomes those at its helm would often wish for. Efforts to reduce poverty bear witness to the challenges of ensuring that public services deliver for everyone. It's a major challenge for governments across the world, no matter what the size of their GDP or tax revenue. So how do we enhance the role of public services in ensuring nobody is left behind when the next framework of development goals is agreed? But more importantly, how do we help governments get things done? It's a lively debate. Whilst everybody accepts the importance of understanding country contexts, there is some disagreement about what this means in practice. President of the World Bank, Jim Kim, has pushed the idea of a science of delivery, which advocates tasking a small number of people with measuring and ensuring the delivery of services. Critics suggest this ignores the size of the political hurdles they may face. Owen Barder and others advocate a complexity approach that concedes many political problems are often impossible to fully get your head around and advocates a more iterative or adaptive approach. But this time, critics suggest there's a risk of overlooking valuable lessons about what does work. So is there a middle ground? ODI recently hosted an event to discuss the politics of delivery. We were joined by Shanta Devarajan, the World Bank's chief economist for the Middle East and North Africa. I caught up with him and Lenny Wild of the ODI's Politics and Governance programme to explore this a little bit further. I began by asking Lenny for her take on the debate.
I think what is great is that we're building up a much better picture of this puzzle of why is it so hard to get equitable and better quality services in many countries. And there's some important contributions that have been made. The World Bank's science of delivery approach, for example, puts a really important emphasis on implementation, on delivery, on getting things done. But we know that it takes more than just delivery units and better targets to actually improve services in that way. Equally, discussion on complexity offers some really good contributions because we know that development processes are much more messy, unpredictable, they involve lots of stakeholders. Recognising that is good, but we also know that doesn't answer all of the questions of why some governments seem to do better than others in delivering services despite those issues.
So are there common problems that we start from when looking at this issue? Shanta Devarajan says so.
Oh, for sure, there are some common problems. Some of them are not as obvious as they seem. I mean, we do observe services being delivered poorly to poor people in particular. And the common problems are that the service providers are frequently not accountable to anybody. So that's why we observe teachers are absent, teachers are unqualified, medicines get stolen from the clinics, and overall the operation of the system is dysfunctional when it comes to serving poor people. But there's another set of common problems, which we're discussing today at ODI, which is that the underlying political system actually conspires to make service delivery difficult. Often the money that is allocated for, say, health and education is captured in order to serve the non-poor. So that's why you observe free public hospitals concentrated in urban areas and very little money going towards primary clinics, and even less money going to immunization services, which is what poor people really need. And this is a very difficult problem to crack because it's the underlying politics of the country. Often it's captured by labor unions, but not always. Sometimes there's a dictator in charge who doesn't care about poor people. I mean, just to give you one example, Gabon, which is a very wealthy country, it's an oil-rich country with a per capita income of $10,000. Has the second lowest child immunization rate in Africa. So they have lower immunization rates than Togo or Eritrea, which have a tenth of their per capita income.
And according to Lenny, they are not the only ones.
So there's issues, I think, about whether people really believe the promises that politicians are making in terms of service delivery, but also whether voters are voting on that basis, or whether it's on the private benefits that perhaps they receive from their MP. Another issue is whether people, particularly those in power, are able to corner and to dominate a particular process. So in Nepal, for example, when we've looked at issues of why are there no health workers or not enough health workers in rural areas, we can see it's partly about the power of unions and political parties and political patronage that means certain people can stay in more privileged areas in Kathmandu rather than going to their rural postings. There are issues about whether different groups are able to come together and to address problems together. Sometimes we think this is something that should be fixed by our local authority or by our MP, but in reality it takes inputs from lots of different people, from lots of different levels of government, and also from outside government, sometimes from citizens themselves, and are we able to do that? There are issues about whether there are sanctions for performance and clear roles and responsibilities. In Malawi, for example, where there have been critical shortages of medicines, we can see part of the problem actually lies in erratic processes of decentralisation, where people no longer are very clear on who's responsible for different elements of drug supply, and that opens up the space for mismanagement of some of those medicines. And finally, I think there are issues about whether you can really get away with doing something or not doing something because of the actions of others. So sometimes, for example, where aid is stepping in to provide aspects of services, it can really remove the incentives that governments might have to take on that delivery function themselves. Now, there are other dynamics too, but these, from our experience, have been some of the most common ones and some of the ones which can be most detrimental to improving issues of equity, but also access to services.
So there are plenty of problems. What do we know about the answers? According to Shanta, accountability and transparency are key factors when you look at which governments have performed well.
Governments have dealt, the ones that have dealt with this problem well are the ones where they've been forced to do so by their own citizens. So it's not because they read the 2004 World Development Report or somebody came from Washington or London to tell them how to do this, but rather that enough citizens were empowered to demand better services. So and I think a good example is in India, when this group called Pratham started examining school children and found that their test scores were very low. And they did it throughout the country and they publicized it. And the information now became part of the general lexicon. And then the government couldn't ignore the fact that they were putting a lot of money into public schools and not having anything to show for it. So I think the examples I've seen have all been ones where the citizens, and the majority of whom are poor and are suffering from these poor services, are able to bring pressure to bear on the political system.
So what does this mean for aid donors who are trying to support public service delivery?
Well, I think recognising these issues gives us some good pointers in terms of what kinds of conditions might need to be in place for large-scale investment in public services. But I think it also goes further than that, because it also gives us some signs of what aid itself could do to change in the way that it's delivering its support. A couple of clear things come out. One is that reforms really need to be led by domestic stakeholders. That might often be governments themselves, but it also can be others. It can be citizens, it can be other groups within a country, but they need to be in the driving seat. And that donors should really be playing a role that's about facilitating, supporting, and nudging those processes along rather than trying to come in and substitute for them. But secondly, I think if we start with this idea of a more problem-driven approach, I think it leads us to understanding that we need much more flexible and adaptive models as well. This isn't about planning and having all your activities pinned down over a 3 or a 5 year period. It's about setting some clear objectives, but then opening yourself up to respond to changing conditions on the ground, to adapt as your environment changes in terms of the kind of support that you give. And you know, this should really be common sense. If we're setting out on a long car journey, we keep our destination fixed, but we vary our route depending on the things we encounter on the road, the traffic, the roadblocks. And so if it makes sense when we do that, you know, it should make sense when we think about these much more complex reform processes as well.
And what about for donors like the World Bank? How can their aid make a difference?
Well, aid is not just money. Aid is about a program of assistance to a country in order to solve some of the problems of the country. So you take a question like service delivery, and we can actually provide knowledge assistance, including collecting some of this data. I mean, one of the things that we do now in Africa is actually collect data on service delivery indicators and put it out there for the public to see. That's a form of aid. But what it does is that it actually then, as I was saying before, can mobilize citizens to bring pressure to bear on the system for reform, which then could make the direct financial assistance more productive. So you need that combination, but you need it in that direction, that is, the knowledge assistance drives the lending assistance.
The United Nations General Assembly is expected to be dominated by conversations about the continuing conflict in Syria. But away from the headlines, a great deal of work will also be going into moving forward the process to renew the Millennium Development Goals. Over the last decade, the MDGs have provided much of the architecture of international development efforts. They are credited with helping to drive a period of unprecedented progress in poverty reduction through focusing the efforts of aid donors and country governments on a concrete set of targets. There is much to be admired in what has been achieved so far, but 2015 marks the expiry date of the current goals. UK Prime Minister David Cameron co-chaired a panel of politicians tasked with scoping out the room for improvement when it comes to striking a new deal, commonly known as a post-2015 agreement. The General Assembly marks the beginning of the end of a long period of consultation, which has involved gathering submissions from across the world. One of the most innovative elements of this has been the My World Survey. A UN-backed survey with partners including ODI and Ipsos Mori captures the priorities of people across the world. It's now received over 1 million votes. I spoke to Paul Ladd of the United Nations Development Programme to find out a bit more about what the consultations, which go far beyond My World, have revealed. I began by asking him to summarise the findings so far.
I think there are three main messages that we've picked up in our report on the consultations. The first one is that, and this comes out very strongly in the My World survey, there are things in the existing MDG agenda which are still critically important for people all over the world, including poor people in poorer countries, but also people in other countries too. And they're things like education, health, water, food, etc. The second message has been that even on those areas, there are ways in which goals, but also government action, can be improved to make a real difference to people's lives. An example here is on education, where people are focusing much more on the quality of education, what people are leaving schools with. And the third big message has been that people are really calling for a more sophisticated and transformative agenda. They're looking to strengthen some of the environmental components that were in the MDG 7 and in the Millennium Declaration. They're looking for decent jobs, partly, for income, so they can pay for other things, but also for the dignity of employment, so they can look after themselves and their families. They're calling for better governance, to increase their say in the way that governments represent them. And lastly, and somewhat obviously, they want to live in a peaceful world where they're not afraid of being attacked. I don't have personal security concerns that they're not facing a lot of crime.
So should we expect the findings of the consultation to influence the political process?
I always emphasise that at the end of the day, it is going to be governments that are going to be putting together any new agenda for development. But since the consultation started, which was September last year, they've been feeding into the political process on a weekly basis, and that's been part of our job. So they've influenced the findings of the high-level panel report. The report from the scientific community through the SDSN was strongly influenced by the consultations. And when we came to put together the SG's report over the summer, again, we drew significantly on the consultations. So a lot of the inputs already crafted to feed into the political process have already been informed by these 1 million voices. Now, the intergovernmental process is picking up speed through something called an open working group. And for each of those meetings, we, the UN system, put together a 6-page note which captures the main technical issues around each topic they want to discuss. Even in that briefing note, we're putting in the findings of the consultations. We're reflecting on how many people around the world are actually putting this as a priority. So we're even starting to inform the intergovernmental process as well.
It is noticeable that climate change doesn't feature highly in many consultation responses, and yet the United Nations are hoping to bring together the sustainability and poverty reduction efforts, combining the MDGs and the SDGs. Is this likely to be a problem?
Environmental sustainability is one part of the sustainability agenda. The outcome from Rio captures sustainability in many dimensions, economic, social, environmental, and also makes a strong reference to governance and peace and security too. To cut to the chase, for some people who are facing very, very extremely difficult conditions every day, it's more difficult to see the longer term creeping impacts of climate change than it is when you're faced with the challenge of getting enough food, enough water, getting your kids into school, accessing healthcare and things like that. So particularly we've noticed in Africa, climate change comes out towards the bottom of the survey. But if you look at richer countries, we now have an interactive map on our website, and you can pull up a sort of heat map on climate change. And you can see that the richer countries particularly place climate change higher up their agenda. And also countries that are wealthy in natural resources, they also place some of the environmental sustainability components higher up in the survey. So it's interesting when you have a map like that and you can see some of the geopolitical breakdowns of the priorities in the survey.
So if climate will remain a feature of a new agreement, do we know yet where the agenda will be slimmed down? Presumably it's impossible to please everybody.
Not all of the issues that people have raised through the consultations are being reflected in that emerging consensus. I don't think we're going to see, for example, standalone goals on some of the issues which have come out less strongly in the consultations. But there'll be a way of reflecting part of their priorities in it. If I take one example, there's been an incredibly strong engagement from young people around the world. And even some youth groups were calling for a goal which focused exceptionally on young people. Now, I don't think we will see that in the end, but what we hopefully will see is a much better breakdown of data that allows us to track progress for young people on all of the priority areas that are chosen in the end. And that's one way of making sure that we're actually then meeting the needs of young people around the world.
As I mentioned earlier, this week the My World survey topped 1 million votes. ODI's Claire Melamed was involved in creating the survey and has remained closely involved ever since. I asked her how the idea first came about.
We had lots of conversations within the UN system, with our partners Ipsos Mori about how to do it, with all kinds of technology companies and so on. And the idea has exploded. It's amazing how people have taken up, responded with such enthusiasm, the call to get as many votes as possible. So a university student in Brazil has collected hundreds of votes from around his university. There's a website in Egypt that put it on their front page, and we got thousands of votes from Egypt in just a few days. There's people collecting votes from teenage girls in refugee camps in Rwanda. It's absolutely amazing how people have picked this up and made it their own. And it really is thanks to those people that we've reached a million votes this week.
So has the breadth of the 2015 consultation helped a clear agenda to emerge?
I'm afraid my answer is yes and no. No, because part of the excitement of the conversation is its breadth and the fact that so many people are enthusiastically engaging in conversations about inequality, about environmental sustainability, about some of the really tough issues that haven't really had a political process through which to think and talk about them. I think that conversation itself is worth having. Some of it will be reflected in the post-2015 goals, and some of it will come out in all kinds of ways that we don't know yet, in national level policy, in the policies of different organisations, companies, and so on. Yes, though, because in fact, in my world at least, the results are amazingly consistent. One of the big surprises is we've sat down to look at the data right from the beginning, was how consistent the results are between men and women, between young people and old people, rich and poor countries. Almost everybody puts education at the top. Healthcare comes very high. People really care about their governments, an honest and responsive government also very high. Desire for better job opportunities, not surprisingly, is pretty universal. So there's a diversity. There's also quite a large amount of consensus, at least at the top five or six priorities globally.
And what's been the biggest surprise so far?
One of the things that we're doing in my world is experimenting with different ways of getting information from people. And that's, you know, a lot of technology companies and mobile phone companies have enthusiastically helped us with that. One of the interesting things we're finding is that when we go out and try to collect votes by mobile phone, a vast majority, between sort of 70 and 90% of the votes are coming from men. We don't quite yet know why this is, because when you look at use of mobile phones for banking, for example, proportions of men and women are roughly similar. So it's a bit of a puzzle, but it's a fascinating puzzle, and also one which, to me, sounds a note of caution about all the enthusiasm around using mobile phones to collect information. Of course, we should do that, but we need to keep an eye on things like who's actually responding.
Thank you for listening to the ODI Monthly Podcast. If you want more information on the topics discussed in this month's podcast, you can take a look at the related links section of the ODI podcast webpage. If you want to get in touch, drop us a line on media@odi.org.uk. If you've enjoyed listening, why not subscribe to the monthly podcast using iTunes or Audioboo? Thanks for listening.